From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines. And don't forget, as you drift off to sleep Saturday night into Sunday morning, for those of you who make the switch to daylight saving time, clocks ahead 1 hour. You know the old saying, spring ahead, fall back. Here's what's happening. A leading general in North Korea claims the country has a long-range missile armed with nuclear warheads on standby. North Korea has repeated its vow to ditch all non-aggression pacts with South Korea and again threatened a preemptive nuclear attack on the United States as well. The regime also announced that it plans to cut off phone lines between North and South Korea as part of a defiant response to tough new sanctions imposed by the United Nations Security Council. A man shot and killed the host of a television program about shooting while the host was visiting his wife. Wayne Bengston, 41 years old, then beat his wife, took his two-year-old son to a relative's house, and then drove to his home where he apparently killed himself. The victim was 43-year-old Gregory Rodriguez, host of the Sportsman's Channel, a Rifleman's Journal. Bengston's wife told police that Rodriguez was in town on business and visiting her at her mother's house when her husband showed up. It was not clear how Rodriguez and the woman were acquainted. A town of 140 people in western Maine is considering an ordinance making gun ownership mandatory, the latest of a handful of communities nationwide to pass or consider such a rule, even though the measures are widely considered unenforceable. John Lott, senior research scientist at the University of Maryland and author of More Guns, Less Crime. Now, John, you know what? I'm a right-to-bear-arms type of guy, but I think this is the opposite. I don't think you can force people to buy a gun. What do you think?
And I agree with you. And if one looks at these laws carefully, what you find is that there are conscientious objectors, places that you have in the law where you just don't have to follow through with it. So it's more kind of a statement by these towns than actually forcing people to go and buy guns. It's interesting. I mean, it seems to have had some impact on crime rates in those areas, so making that type of statement at least seems to convince some criminals to stay away from those areas.
but as they say, they really can't enforce that. They can't force somebody to buy a gun.
That's exactly right.
Okay, John, thank you so much. John's website, part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. They say that bees could hold the key to preventing HIV transmission. Researchers have discovered that bee venom kills the virus while leaving the body cells unharmed. This could lead to an auto-HIV gel and other treatments. Bumblebee Foods has more than doubled the size of its recall of some of its 5-ounce canned tuna because of a risk that the fish could become contaminated and spoil. Bumblebee said it's now recalling 51,000 cases of canned tuna. That's up from its original 22,500. Each case contains 24 to 48 cans. The company said the canned seals may not be tight enough. Loose seals could let those germs spoil the tuna, sickening an eater. The cans distributed to retailers all around the country between January 17th and Wednesday. They have Best Buy dates that range from January 14th, 2016 to 2016 of January 18th. So just keep your check on that. The amount of salt in our diet could be involved in driving our own immune systems to rebel against us, leading to diseases such as multiple sclerosis. Several teams of scientists have published data in the journal Nature suggesting a link. Salt may activate a part of the immune system that can target the body. More than 60 people had food poisoning at a Danish restaurant dubbed the world's best eatery. Health officials said the diners at the Noma restaurant there fell sick over a 5-day period. They think there might have been a sick kitchen employee. And Whole Foods says all products in its North American stores that contain genetically modified ingredients will be labeled as such by 2018. Jeffrey Smith, of course, genetic roulette author, and of course he looks at genetically modified foods. Jeffrey, why is it going to take so long, 2018? Why don't they just do it right now?
Well, it takes some time for the companies to reformulate. But this actually is a very, very good announcement, and it rides the wake of, although Prop 37 in California, which would have required mandatory labeling, was defeated narrowly in November, it really propelled the issue onto a national stage, and already non-GMO project verified products are the fastest growing label claim in America. Someone from Whole Foods said today that when something gets verified as non-GMO, the sales can go up by 15%. Wow. So they're saying to the entire industry, it's like laying down a gauntlet, it's time now that we give transparency to consumers. And really, with 22 states now considering bills for labeling, and Washington State has a ballot initiative in November, this is going to happen. And this is just the latest in the very, very powerful wave of consumers saying, we don't want to eat GMOs, we want them labeled so we can choose non-GMO. There's right now $3.5 billion of products sold last year of verified non-GMO products. You can find them at non-GMOshoppingguide.com.
All right, this just might be the impetus to get things going. Well, can we say that? Happy days are here again. Hiring picked up in February, helping to bring the unemployment rate down to its lowest level since December of 2008. The U.S. economy added 236,000 jobs in the month, according to the Labor Department. That's much stronger than in January. The gains were broad-based as offices, restaurants, construction firms, hospitals all added jobs. Unemployment rate dipped to 7.7%. 12 million workers counted as unemployed. The drop, they say, partly because people said they got jobs, but also because 130,000 people simply gave up and dropped out of the labor force altogether. Well, here we go again. An asteroid the size of a city block will pass by Earth this weekend. Don't worry, they say. No danger of hitting the planet. It's 262 feet wide. The asteroid makes its closest approach to good old planet Earth Saturday afternoon. It will be about 604,000 miles away. Up next, we're going to talk about ESP, poltergeists, and the strange and unusual. Dr. Barry Taft joins us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Barry Taft, a parapsychologist, has examined more than 3,200 reported hauntings in 26-plus years. Many of those occurred between 1968 and 78 when he served as a research associate in the parapsychology lab at the University of California in L.A. Now, that was a division of the neuropsychiatry department, which disbanded. Since then, Barry has served as the technical advisor on such films that you would know, Poltergeist, Altered States, as well as a consultant to the Central Intelligence Agency, FBI, Interpol, and so much more. Welcome back to Coast, Dr. Barry Taft. Barry, how are you?
Fine, George. It's a pleasure being here, hearing your voice online again.
What a difference between working at the university level and then working with the CIA and the FBI. Why the difference?
Well, I mean, this work for the intelligence community was basically related to the work we were doing in ESP, what now they call remote viewing.
Yeah.
It was all done at UCLA. But then the problems began because it was very politically incorrect, even in those days. And what occurred was they were getting too much attention. So we appeared on INLA back in 1976 several times. We hit the front page of the LA Times U section about one of our cases. And then we were teaching parapsychology and extension for a couple of years. And university couldn't take it, so they shut us down.
Too much pressure?
Yeah, it was negative publicity they didn't need.
Yeah.
And so now we went private, and I did different types of work when I was there, George. Part of the work in the lab was developing some methods and protocols to see if we could train people to become more psychic. In other words, enhance their abilities with positive feedback and reinforcement. This went on from 1970-71. Till 1987, even though the lab closed in 1980, at least my end of it closed. And we went private to in different office structures in the Westwood area of Los Angeles. And what we learned about this mechanism was beyond anything we ever imagined, which is what the government was interested in. The evidence strongly suggests that the way we access information paranormally, telepathic, clairvoyant, precognitive, retrocognitive, psychometric, appears to be the same way we may access our own memories. And it's called implicate order. What I mean by that is there was a well-known neurobiologist at Caltech. He basically had a whole floor in the biology building to himself, by the name of Jim Bauer, Dr. Jim Bauer.
Mm-hmm.
And the discoveries he made, along with colleagues around the world, clearly demonstrated that our long-term memories very likely do not reside in our own brain.
See, that's fascinating because, you know, the going argument from science, of course, is that, you know, once the brain dies, so does everything else. This would prove otherwise, wouldn't it?
Well, it's a little more than that and a little less than that, George. The problem is, if the way we're designed to work as human beings is to access information that's remote from our body in order to live on a daily basis, then that's paranormal, literally.
Mm-hmm.
So we're designed, this is the way we may be designed, so therefore when you talk about paranormal experiences, it's not paranormal. This is what's normal for us. Some people are better at it than others. Some people are worse than others. The same way you could take an average person and get them to drive. Some will just be a driver. Some could be race drivers. The reason I say that, I used to road race sports cars. you take people who play any sport, football, baseball, hockey. Some will be all-stars. Some will never
work. Yeah, some people have that natural ability.
Right. In this respect, we learned, we were working at UCLA, which attracted the attention of the intelligence community, the CIA, National Security Agency, Office of Naval Intelligence, Defense Language Institute, DARPA, and they were being brought to our research groups. Initially, we didn't even know who they were, so it was a single blind condition, and the information that we ended up giving them was so state-specific regarding the development of the Trident sub and the D-5 missile. They became so paranoid about what we told them or gave them in terms of information. They took the audio tapes, and they wouldn't let us keep
them. Jeez, did they think there might have been a spy among them?
I don't know what they thought, but I do know that they were very paranoid about the whole matter. And it clearly demonstrated that it's easy for some people to access information through remote from our own brain. But what we have to understand is that there's, as far as we can know or determine at this point, there's no wave or particle going from point A to point B. It's sort of like a hologram.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a normal picture, 8x10, cut it in half, cut it in quarters, cut it in eighths, sixteenths, you get smaller and smaller pieces. However, in our brain, the evidence suggests, according to Dr. Carl Prebram and others, that our brain may be holonomic in the sense that the information within it may be equally distributed at some level. This is born in a book called the by several books written by Dr. Prebram and articles published in refereed clinical journals. What I'm getting at here is it may be the level of space-time is holonomic, which means the information that makes up the past still exists. The information that makes up the future already exists. The information that's far away from us in terms of space is just, it's like it's next to us. So all space and time's information may be encoded in all of space-time. If you take a hologram and you cut it smaller and smaller, each piece will still recreate the whole image due to the information's equal distribution.
Right, it'd just be a smaller version.
Right, lower aperture, smaller aperture, a little less bright, but it's still there. Our brain very likely works like this. Consciousness may work like this. And the paranormal may work like this. The evidence, this is what the evidence suggests, which means that this is normal. This is the way we're designed, and yet science has told us that this can't be real.
And it's got to be very real. Of the 32-plus hauntings you've looked at over the years, what percent would you say, Barry, unexplainable, very likely to be something on the other side?
Yeah, okay. I think you have an old bio on me.
Mm-hmm.
We're close to 4,500 cases.
Wow.
Most of the cases begin and end with one evening or the day. You go visit them. You ask a lot of relevant questions, some very probing, very invasive. You take measurements of the people and the environment, look into the background of the environment. But the probability of any researcher, especially an academician, going out into the field and experiencing phenomena when you're there is like winning the lottery every time you play at the $100 million level or a more morbid relationship would be that of going to the airport with a camcorder and getting a plane crash. It's astronomical against you. So most cases begin and end in one night. There are those occasions where all hell breaks loose. One of those became the novel and motion picture, The Entity, starring Barbara Hershey and the late Ron Silver. What made this case unique was that we began experiencing phenomena almost from the get-go, objects being thrown around, luminous anomalies. The room became very cold, a very disgusting odor of decomposing organic matter. And this went on for months. And we were fortunate to capture some pictures of some of the phenomena. One looks like a comet with a tail on it. Now, these are all in my book, Aliens Above, Ghosts Below. You see a little ball of light with a tail. We saw this that's why we fired at it. Other pictures that are on my book, and I think they're also on your website,
yes,
some time ago, you see the woman, the focal point of the phenomena, Doris Beither, and she's on her little bed, and over her there's a bright arc of light. Now, we never saw that. We saw light flying around her. What we think happened was we caught a time lapse. It's the same way if you're taking pictures of stars at night, you don't have a moving platform, you get a streak. We may have actually caught, we froze it, and we weren't shooting fast enough, so it looks like an arc as opposed to a ball. But what's really important about this image, what's really important, is that behind the arc, behind Doris, the walls meet at a 90-degree angle. If this image was projected into space somehow, as some form of trick or hoax, the image would be bent in accordance with the wall, because it would have to follow.
It follows the whole field.
But it was not, which clearly suggests that this image was in free space. Now, during this case, it was amazing. We put up black poster boards all over Doris's bedroom. And because the picture we were getting, we had no reference. We couldn't tell where the lights were starting from or going to, nor could we tell their speed. So covered the walls and ceiling in black poster boards with gaffer's tape. So we made like a grid, and every grid had a number in it and a magnetic orientation. And as the phenomena grew greater, we saw more lights. And at one point in the case, it's 74 now, in Culver City, California. One of the nights we were there, these always lime green lights, they always coalesced. Well, this particular, they really coalesced, and they formed an apparition from about the waist up. Very, very large man.
How many did it take to form the apparition?
I don't remember how many, but they were probably initially 3 to 4 lights. They seemed to come together, and then the apparition appeared.
It was
a dynamic, articulating image. It seemed to look at us. You could see the head, the brow ridge. You could see the jaw, the neck, the musculature, the pectorals, the shoulders, the arms. And then when it got to the waist, it just basically faded out. And it was amazing because we were watching this, and yet what are we seeing? How are we seeing it? What's even more amazing, George, is that we couldn't photograph it. We must have photographed hundreds of pictures.
And nothing took.
Hundreds of frames of film. It was lighting up the room. We could see each other's faces. We could see the tripod and the cameras. You could almost walk around the room. There were over 22 people in the room.
Jeez.
And yet we couldn't photograph.
Why wouldn't it take on film at the time?
Well, one of the theories is that we weren't seeing it. Our mind was perceiving it. It was something was directly affecting our brain.
Do you think that was possible?
Anything's possible, but why would that then show up as lights later on?
That's right.
Some of it's photogenic and other parts of it are not. What's intriguing about this case, that takes it out well beyond the area of parapsychology, is Doris claimed from the get-go that she'd been repeatedly sexually assaulted, raped, by an entity. Two small ones and one large one. The small ones would hold her down, the large one would rape her. She had 3 male children, each from a different man. She had a lot of problems in the house, emotionally, substance abuse, the whole bit. And it's a little odd psychologically that there were 3 male entities that basically fit the description of her.
Yeah, well, hold on for a second, Barry. Let's get into that when we come right back. Okay, the iPhone app is out. It is free to all of you. And if you're a Coast Insider, you've got some special things within that iPhone app. So take advantage of that. $0.15 a day, by the way, to become a Coast Insider. And really soon now, the Android app will be launched. The beta version has been massaged, and it's almost ready to go. I'm going to guess week or two, maybe? Pretty close. Maybe even next week. And that, again, is free to all of you Android users. You'll be able to download that. You'll be able to get it out of the Google Store when it's ready or pick it off a link off our website. So enjoy that. And to be a Coast Insider, again, 15 cents a day, simply go to coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Dr. Barry Taff. His book, Aliens Above, Ghosts Below, his website, Barry Taff, TAFF.net, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Barry, let's get back to this incredible case of Doris. Is it possible, because she was, you know, she had babies from three different people, three different guys, and then she had these apparitions molest her, basically. Could she have conceived this? Could she have conjured these things up?
Right. Yes. The answer to my opinion is yes. I don't think this was a case of a haunting. I think this was a case of a poltergeist. Now, this is what we keep running into over and over again. People that have a troubled, they're troubled emotionally, physically, psychodynamically with the family that are each other's throats, and the phenomena reflects part of that chaos. The most incredible thing we've learned, though, is so bizarre and unexpected that if I went back in time 30 years ago and told this to myself, I'd go, you're out of your mind. It seems that the majority of these cases, there's got to be three variables that work in relationship to each other before things happen. One is you have a particular location, geomagnetic anomaly, geophysically active, electromagnetic anomaly. Two, a person there who is hypersensitive to these energy levels. Their nervous system is wired in such a way to where energies that would not affect most people affect them. It's sort of like if you put on flashy lights in front of people's closed eyes, it drives their brain waves. This could be driving the nervous systems of these individuals. And even more bizarre, the majority of people who are plagued with these events related to them tend to be either seizure-prone or epileptic. However, most people who are seizure-prone or epileptic are not poltergeist agents, which means there's a missing or unknown variable. One of them is probably the person's inability to cope with stress.
Or some kind of trauma?
Well, yeah, it's all related.
Okay.
Doris Beither was living in a very chaotic, stressful environment. She had four children, three boys and a girl. We never saw her little daughter, but we knew of her. And at one point, I remember a fuse box tore itself out of the wall and just missed Doris's head. Another time, candelabras flew at her and hit her. But the most incredible thing was we get a call from her at 1 in the morning. We go down, it's Culver City, we all lived in West L.A. at the time, and all the poster boards on the walls and ceiling of her bedroom had been torn off, and the plaster and paint came off with it. Now, they were piled up on the floor. We got there, Doris was panicked, she was really upset and quite frightened. She could have done this, but she was a small woman, just a little bigger than me. And, you know, at the time she was about, I think, 9 or 10 years older than me. By her reaction to what had just happened, I don't think she faked it. Now, what is bizarre, other things would happen. There are other pictures that we captured. One of them, which is also on your site, shows arcs. Again, these arcs of light, but they're inverted. One arc is goes down from the top, comes around to the top. The other one starts at the bottom and arcs around to the bottom. And yet, we saw nothing other than balls of light at the time. Now, finally, Doris gets up and moves. He moves from Culver City to Carson. Carson is far worse than it was then. I don't know if it is now. Area to live in. It's just a crime-ridden area. So we go out. We meet with her. And we assumed it was over. Not quite. How we found her was with the help of Frank DiFelita, who had already met her through us. And he was writing the novel for the entity.
Okay.
So we found her. We're in a new place. And this is all in my book. This is chapter two of my book called The Real Life Entity Case. And what's amazing, in a new place, things start happening. We're sitting there, and a large vase flew across the room, missing everyone, smashing into the floor between us. her neighbors, who knew nothing about the case, she didn't speak of it because she didn't want to be labeled as a troubled, disturbed lady, wise on her part. The neighbors started having poltergeist activity in their homes shortly after she moved. So it looks like it's radiant. It's a proximity effect.
Yeah.
She moved from there to Texas. Phenomena. No, it'll be from Carson. She moved to San Bernardino. The phenomena followed her there. Then she moved to Texas. It followed her there, but then it stopped. By the time the movie came out in 1983, it was all but over. Now, her children say they're adults now. One of her boys, or now it's a man, said that phenomena, little things were happening around her until she died. Doris Spitzer died in 1999 at the age of 58 of, I think, respiratory arrest.
Young age.
Pulmonary failure. And they never determined why that happened, why her body quit. They just, that's the cause of death. What caused it, they don't know.
What do you think?
I don't speculate without facts.
No.
All I know is that now I become friends with a really nice guy named Javier Ortega from ghosttheory.com. Good friend, collects a lot of information. He had talked with all of her children, except I think even, I don't know if he spoke to the lady, but I know to the men, the boys. And they were telling stories that before we even met her, things were happening in her old home in Santa Monica. Then she moved to in Culver City. And not long after she moved in, a little dinky, almost like a bungalow, and this Hispanic lady comes up to her one day at the door, "You must leave this place. It's evil. It's bad." And Doris, "Who are you?" Woman leaves. What the heck is that? And of course, shortly thereafter, things really started to increase in their magnitude.
So it had events going on, though, before she even got there.
Well, all that we know is what the woman told Doris.
Right.
We don't know why or what the specifics were.
Unless the woman felt something from Doris and wanted her out of there.
We don't know. All that we do. Well, now what's intriguing is the types of phenomena. The first time we were there, August 22nd, 1974, very hot night, very muggy. The first thing Doris tells us is that she'd been repeatedly raped by a ghost. We rolled our eyes back and went, "All right, you know, nice seeing you."
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a big T on the top of the form, which meant psychotic. We recommended that she see a psychiatrist at UCLA. About 10 days later, she called us. Her friends have seen it. Neighbors have seen things. So we come back to her little home on Braddock Drive in Culver City. We're in the kitchen interviewing her, and the lower cupboard door flies open, and an iron skillet flies out in a ballistic arcing trajectory and hits the floor.
Now, for a moment, are you thinking this is a setup?
Well, we looked for springs, we looked for kids or animals, wires, we found nothing.
Nothing. Okay.
And what was odd, there was, like I said, the foul smell was really, was horrible. We brought in what's called a sniffer from Hewlett-Packard, and we could not trace the source of the odor. But that the odor stopped. The bedroom also was very cold. It was very hot outside that time of year, even during the day, very muggy nights. The bedroom felt like it was refrigerated, but we didn't determine the source. Now, what's interesting is that just said Doris moved, the phenomenon moved with her. If I could go back in time and do and investigate the case again, we now have portable instruments we take out, geomagnetometers, ion counters, low-frequency spectrum analyzers, non-contact infrared thermometers, things like that. I would have done that, but I also would have run her up, medically speaking, from a neurological standpoint. I'd be willing to bet that she has some neurological problems. And we had a case almost identical to the entity, happened in 1989 and 93 in San Pedro, chapter 3 of my book called A Hazardous Haunting. Woman called us in 89 in the summer. Long story short, things are happening in a little bungalow on 11th Street in San Pedro. We go out there, very similar to the entity. Same organic odor of decomposing matter. We started seeing things. Some viscous liquid is coming out of the walls.
Like oozing out?
Yeah, we could not determine the source. We sampled it. We went to a lab, and they just said it was human blood plasma with a high copper and iodine content. Why is that coming out of her walls?
Yeah, exactly.
We were taking a lot of photos. I was working at that time with Barry Conrad. He's a professional photographer and brought his high-end camera gear. Strange lights were being seen. We didn't see with our naked eyes. And we heard like a pounding of a 200-pound rat bouncing around the attic. We went up in the attic. We saw nothing. Jeff was the last one up there. He's taking pictures. We hear a scream. Jeff Wheatcraft comes down out of the attic. He's about 6'2", about 210 pounds. And he's shaking, white as a sheet. He's shaking. Something pulled the camera, the 35-millimeter camera, out of his hand and separated it. The lens landed safely in a fruit box on one side of the attic. The body landed on the other side, completely intact, without damage.
Why do these entities, Barry, seem to be so angry?
Well, here's the thing. In Jackie's case, just like the entity, the evidence strongly suggested it's the manifestation. It was called recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. It's mind over matter on the part of Jackie. Now, what's intriguing, we don't know if the environment is geomagnetically active, but I'd be willing to bet it is. We haven't been back there with instruments because, you know, we have to be asked to go there. What's intriguing, the phenomena kept attacking Jeff over and over. It's in my book. It's on my website. Why is it attacking Jeff? It also began attacking Barry Conrad a little bit. Didn't bother me at all. Why not me?
Why not you?
Yeah. I was the shortest. I had the least hair. They had the worst skin and the poorest vision, but that's not the point. The point is that...
Good for you.
the point is, Jackie, nice lady, in a terrible situation. Her husband abandoned her when she was pregnant with the second kid.
So another trauma, another episode like that.
What happened is Jackie she was very attracted to Barry Conrad for good reason. Tall man, dark hair, blue eyes, looks like a young Elvis.
Yeah.
Friendly, intelligent, great cameraman, very dedicated. And Jeff was always around when we were there. And she looked at Jeff as an impediment to her growing closer to Barry. And what did she want? She wanted Jeff out of the way. What happens repeatedly? The phenomena attacks Jeff.
Jealous.
At one point on September 4th, 89, Jeff's in the attic again. They're all about to come down. And we hear a yell, a loud yell. Jeff comes flying. No, he's up in the attic with a man named Gary Bame. Couldn't see, turned around, used the flash bulb of the camera. We see Jeff, a clothesline had wrapped itself around his neck in a bowline knot and was picking him up over the rafter, literally hanging him. Had Gary Bame not been in the attic at that point, Jeff Wheatcraft would have been hanged. He would have died. But there was nothing else up there other than Jeff and Gary Bame. Jeff comes out of the attic shaking, perspiring heavily, with a rope burn in his neck. We never determined what happened, but it got worse. Jackie finally gets up the ability to move, moves up to Weldon, California, about 300 some odd miles north near Bakersfield. Long story short, it's all in the book. It's also in Barry Conrad's video, An Unknown Encounter. Phenomena breaks out at Jackie's new place.
Same thing.
Yeah. Even worse. Barry and Jeff go up there to see what they can do. I couldn't at the time because my father had a heart attack. And the things that went on were amazing. These strange luminous anomalies flying around at very high speed. The couch bouncing up and down like it weighed a milligram. And at one point, at the table holding a little seance, Jeff, chair with Jeff in it is levitated up in the air. The chair drops down. Jeff continues up, arcing upwards, and he hits the wall where it meets the ceiling. He slammed into the floor. They thought he was dead. And he described it as a compression of his diaphragm, and he felt a lifting sensation, and then he blacked out. But this man weighs 200 plus pounds, 6'3" or 6'4". Before the energies we know of, electromagnetism, strong weak nuclear, and gravity, before they would move you based on what we know, not only would you get hot and burst into flames, everything else in the room would burst into flames because of the heat.
It was that hot.
Yeah. It's thermodynamics. Anything energy does work, it produces heat. This energy does not produce heat. We did a hard copy show about the case, and I asked Jackie on the show, what do you think of Jeff Wheatcraft? And she said, I don't like him. What do you want to happen? I wish he was out of the way. He almost was. Somebody tried to kill him three times. Jeff was wise enough to walk away from the case because he realized that this could kill him. What's amazing is wherever Jackie went, it went with her. And another point, it came to her new apartment. She was staying down in San Pedro again, visiting friends in a motel. She comes back to the motel, and in the room, she looks at the walls, on the walls and ceiling, and big red marker pencil, like a Mark Salat, are the words mad and angry. The walls are covered, mad and angry, mad and angry. If you had to describe Jackie's personality, her state of mind at that time, she was mad as hell and very angry. These things basically disenfranchised her. She lost her home.
They're carbon copies of the human, aren't they?
Yeah, an extension of a living human consciousness.
Yes.
And again, would have been intriguing to test her neurologically speaking, do medical workups on her. I'm convinced that we have enough knowledge now to reverse engineer the process, meaning that instead of waiting around for something to happen, scratching our heads going, when will it work? We might be able to modify the environment. This is on my website and in my book, that we can modify the electromagnetic environment to drive the phenomena in these individuals. And then all bets are off because we can document it directly because we can make it happen. The problem is this might injure the person, the poltergeist agent, might even kill them. You never, under any circumstances, do anything that harms another individual. It's like it's just unethical and immoral. When we're looking at a form of energy that is not like anything we know of, every energy we know of in the universe is basically called exothermic, produces heat as a byproduct, second law of thermodynamics, when it does work. This energy does not. Nothing else we know of does that. If we discover what this is, let's call it zero-point energy, it could change the course of human history. It could power the world. We could send starships out into interstellar space. Heal with it. And I don't know why no one's doing the work, probably because no one's interested yet. But I got a feeling we're looking a gift ghost in the mouth, to the point where it could so radically alter our existence that we may not even be accepting. It's a fundamental change in the way we exist. So the question is, a lot of my colleagues, medical doctors, they can't get involved because it would destroy their career. If I was working at, let's say, UCLA as a professor or USC or Stanford, and I put my book out, I would have been fired.
They just don't want to see that, do they?
It's of no interest. The military might have an interest. They did. It's called remote viewing. That work pretty much ended. And afterwards, the government hired some professional debunkers, whose names I won't mention. The debunkers went out and tried to convince the world that all the results of, you know, Stargate and all the remote was wrong. We misinterpreted the results. There were no results. There is no paranormal phenomena. They hired debunkers to do this. Why? Because they didn't want the public to use this phenomena against them. It's disinformation. Real simple.
Barry, we're going to take some phone calls with you next hour. Dr. Barry Taff, our special guest tonight, to his book, one of them, Aliens Above, Ghosts Below, his website, BarryTaff, TAFF.net. We've got it linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. And if you want to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com as well. And don't forget, those of you, keep your eyes open. The iPhone app is out. You can pick that up. Go to our website. There are links for you there. The Android app, very, very soon. We're very happy with it. You're going to love it. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.